Welcome. Oh, now we have sound. Thanks for being here. Welcome to this talk, Computer Says No, Troubles with Fixing Algorithmic Decision Making. My name is Sebastian Zasulka. I'm a PhD student here in Tübingen. We have our offices up on the hill. That's why they called it Cyber Valley. Really doesn't make much sense. But I'm a philosopher. Philosopher of science, specifically the social sciences, actually. And I work a lot on the use of statistical methods, i.e. machine learning, and then in marketing terms, artificial intelligence, in bureaucratic decision making. And I want to introduce you a little bit into this field of fair machine learning, of algorithmic fairness particularly, and highlight a few sort of critical points and sort of things we should be aware of if we talk about something like fair machine learning. And I want to do this with a sort of number of case studies. Here I brought you two newspaper reports from the last years from the Netherlands, where they used statistical methods to predict welfare fraud. And at some point, the press realized that in the time between 2005 and 2019, more than 26,000 parents were wrongfully accused of committing welfare fraud and obliged to pay back more than 10,000 of euros, obviously bankrupting many families. Over this scandal, the Dutch government actually broke down, triggered new election. Actually, the very same government came back into power afterwards. But that's one of these cases, and especially one that is particularly prevalent in Europe, this idea of that welfare fraud is a big, big problem that we need to tackle, and that we could use machine learning, statistical methods to predict who is likely of committing welfare fraud. So the Netherlands are still trying these things. The city of Amsterdam recently tried to build a fair algorithm for predicting such welfare fraud, or at least cases where welfare fraud is likely. They failed to do so, and I think it's interesting to sort of look into why and where they failed. This report by Lighthouse Reports is pretty interesting in that regard. But similar algorithms are developed in France, in Serbia, Sweden. So this idea of predicting welfare fraud is pretty prevalent in Europe, actually. And there's a second example that was discussed in Austria in 2019-20, where the FPÖ-ÖVP government under Sebastian Kurz, before they also toppled for other reasons, they proposed to use a statistical method to predict the risk of long-term unemployment of people who registered as unemployed. And particularly, they wanted to focus on the middle group, right? They wanted to restrict access to resources for those with a very low predicted risk of long-term unemployment, but also for those with a very high predicted risk of long-term unemployment under ideas of efficiency and austerity politics. So these are examples of cases I deal with in my research, and where sort of public administrations use and want to use statistical methods to make decisions about peoples. And sort of one of the concerns is, well, if we do such a thing, how could be a way to do this fair or just? That's sort of this question for this field of algorithmic fairness. So in general, I look into problems I name prediction allocation problems, because they are public policy problems where we use some kind of social statistical predictions, for example, of the risk of long-term unemployment, of the risk of someone committing a crime, of the risk of someone committing welfare fraud, to determine or at least inform the allocation of scarce social goods, right? So in our Austrian example, we have the AMS, which is sort of the public employment service of Austria, the Arbeitsmarkt service. And we have sort of our unemployed people going there, registering. And then we collect a bunch of data, and we just call this X, and that's sort of a big spreadsheet, basically, right? All the rows are individuals that registered, and all the columns are just features we record about them. I don't know, their height, how many, well, their educational background, where they worked before, stuff like that. Height, probably not, that was, but like features like that. And then we put all this data in our little machine, this computer, and this computer gives us a number, and usually we say this number is a probability, and then we say this probability is somehow predictive of some relevant outcome we care about. And we show this number to a caseworker, and then they determine a course of action, right? They might say, well, you are eligible to certain resources, or you get certain job training, or you don't. And roughly speaking, we usually hope that these actions help and change something in the world, right? Ideally, we would hope that if someone gets certain resources, some job training, that's helped them to find a job. So that sort of changes in the end the very outcome we are predicting. And in this setup, machine learning seems to promise sort of the best of two worlds. At least that's, I believe, how decision makers and politicians perceive these systems, right? They seem to promise something like mechanistic objectivity, but somehow has something to do with fairness, right? No subjective judgments of people sort of flow into the decision making because it's all just statistics and we just let the data speak and these kinds of ideas. But it also seems to promise something like efficiency, right? Via individualized targeting, we really know who are the people that might profit the most from our programs. So we don't use sort of easy blank targeting where we just give, I don't know, something to everyone or something to everyone above a certain age cutoff or something, but we can really individualize our interventions. And that's sort of the second promise. And I think both are sort of highly problematic, and I want to sort of talk a little bit why they're problematic, in what sense they're problematic, and especially highlight that sort of this field of algorithmic fairness, sort of computer scientists, statisticians, researchers that want to fix, if you like, decision making or statistical decision making, why it's problematic that we are so much focused just on the first problem, how to make them fair, and not so much on the second, how to make them efficient. Like that we let these efficiency claims often stand and don't research them so much. And for that, I have three little case studies, one on managing patient care, where I want to present to you these sort of these standard ideas of algorithmic fairness, and then two shorter case studies going back to this idea of fighting long-term unemployment and reducing school dropout rates of pupils, where I want to sort of push that second problem of efficiency again. Okay, let's start with chapter one, managing patient care, and sort of this first big problem, the fairness paradigm, I would just call it here. This is mainly based on this paper here by Obermeier et al. From 2019, who got access to data from a commercial risk prediction tool that is applied in US hospitals. And instruments like these are applied to about 200 million patients per year in the US. And the idea is to improve patient care by providing additional resources to people with sort of many comorbidities. And these programs of providing such additional resources, at least on average, are considered to be effective, right? If someone has a lot of problems, it's usually helpful to sort of give them additional resources to coordinate different types of doctors, different medicines they might take, for example. The key assumption in these setups is that those with the greatest care needs will also benefit the most from these programs. And then the sort of machine learning problem becomes, well, predict future care needs to target those patients. That's sort of the reduced prediction problem that people try to solve. Let's maybe briefly look into sort of what I mean when I say machine learning here. Won't get very technical, but sort of to get a clearer picture of what it is actually we're talking about here. So again, we record a number of variables about our patients, and one of them we call the target variable, that's our Y, and one the others we call our features, or the dependent variables, that's our X, and then this forms our data set, right? It's again just the spreadsheet idea, a lot of rows, that's our individuals, and some then a lot of columns, that's our features and the target variable. And then machine learning is basically, well, supervised machine learning to be more specific, well, given a bunch of examples of such combinations of variables and target variable, find me some predictor, a function f, and that is the machine learning model, right? A machine learning model is nothing more than this little f that takes in some instances and gives me, well, in this case, a number between 0 and 1. And I hope that sort of this function then approximates the probability of the outcome given the data points I've observed. So in other words, for a new patient, one we haven't seen before, guess a plausible value of y, our target variable, given the stuff we have observed about this patient. And we call this guess then a prediction, y hat, to distinguish it from sort of the actual outcome y. And we want to find a function f of x that gives us these predictions that is good in some sense, right? That is machine learning, roughly. Obviously, sort of how you do this, that's then the technical question, but that's sort of enough for the context of this talk. So what is a good function, a good binary classifier in our case? Well, we have many ways to formalize this, but most are functions of this little thing here, the confusion matrix, which is arguably a little bit confusing, but especially the names people attach to all these things are super confusing. So on the top, we have the actual outcomes, right? And we are in a simple binary case, so we predict, I don't know, just whether someone will get unemployed, long-term unemployed or not, or something like that. And that can be either the case or not the case. So y can be either 0 or 1. And then in the first column, we have our predictions, right? And we can either predict that person 0 or 1, whatever the binary outcomes are. And that gives us these four possible results, where we say, well, either we predict 0 and actually the outcome is 0, then it's a true negative, or we predict 1 and the outcome is actually 1, then it's a true positive. And on the off diagonal, we get the errors, right? Either we predict 1, but it's actually 0, then it's a false positive or false negative. And that is super crucial because most of the accuracy metrics that we can then produce are some functions of these combination of outcomes we can observe. So that's why this little metrics here is so important. So for example, we could look at the accuracy. And that gives us just the probability that what we predict is the actual outcome, right? Or we can look at the error rate, so at the false positives or the false negatives, and we can just look at how often do we make these kinds of errors? How often do we make false positive claims or false negative claims? Or we can flip, if you like, the sort of arguments in the probability statement and look at what is called the predictive value or sometimes also the precision. Right, so we could look at the, for the error rates, we look at the probability of predicting something given the actual outcome, and now we just flip that, and we look at the probability of the outcome given that we predicted something. And why I'm talking about all these things is because a huge chunk of the algorithmic fairness literature basically looks at sort of goodness properties of classifiers, and checks whether these apply sort of similarly across different groups. That's why I wanted to have these sort of here on my slides. And going back to our example of predicting sort of care needs, what we see here on the left side is on the x-axis the percentile of the predicted algorithmic risk scores for patients. And on the y-axis, we see the actual number of active chronic conditions the patients were in. And what you can see is that there are two groups forming, and nicely they colored them for us so we can sort of see them even more directly. What you see is that for any percentile, any threshold we might pick on the x-axis, if you go up then, you see that the number of chronic conditions the patients are in, white patients are actually less sick than black patients. And that holds sort of at any point on this axis, so that for any predicted level of risk, white patients are actually less sick than black patients in these algorithms, well, in this specific algorithm. And that's essentially a violation of the last condition here of this predictive value conditional. And that matters because in this program we use the 97th percentile to automatically enroll patients into this program where we provide additional resources to people. It essentially means white patients need to be less sick to get access to this additional care, while black patients need to be much sicker. And I hope that gives a first idea why there's something problematic with sort of using these risk tools and risk predictions. And it sort of links to anti-discrimination legislation, which knows a number of socially salient groups that have struggled for and won protection from discrimination on the basis of, for example, sex, race, gender, language, religion, age, and the list goes actually on. So we have norms in the US, for example, of disparate treatment and disparate impact that are supposed to protect people from such discriminatory behavior. And disparate treatment here means sort of really protect people from from actions where individuals intended to discriminate on the basis of one of these group memberships, where disparate impact is supposed to cover cases where we have sort of seemingly neutral decision-making processes, but they produce anyway sort of differential outcomes. In the EU and the UK, we have sort of similar ideas. We call them direct and indirect discrimination. They are related. Direct discrimination in indifference to disparate treatment focuses less on the intent to discriminate, but it's sort of similar in its rough meaning. I mean, the detailed legislation are complicated, of course, but sort of roughly we can say disparate treatment and direct discrimination are sort of one bucket of legal protection, and disparate impact and indirect discrimination are roughly trying to protect us from similar discriminatory actions. And obviously, we also have political norms like, equality of opportunity, equality of outcomes that are sort of structuring our ideas of what it means to live in a fair and just society. Given these anti-discrimination legislation, people now consider, how can we translate these legal norms into, tech language, into the language of making predictions? And here we actually get a zoo of fairness metrics that are somewhat supposed to translate these anti-discrimination ideas to algorithms and to predictions. And the first idea is pretty simple. It's often called anti-classification, or fairness through unawareness. And the idea is, we simply don't show our predictors the protected attributes, right? We simply don't tell them the gender of people or their racial background or ethnicity. The problem is these information are often indirectly encoded in other parts of our data, and especially machine learning algorithms are pretty good in sort of reverse engineering them. So just not recording this information in our data set is usually not enough to not provide this kind of information to the algorithm. So that's why people invented other ways to do that. And these are three common examples. The first here, the sort of number two on my slides, encodes the idea that, maybe our predictions, the risk scores we produce, should be statistically independent of the group membership, for example, race in our case. That sort of strengthens this idea of fairness through unawareness, because we now have statistical means to test that. And it roughly means something like, if I give you my predictions, there's no way you can learn, or you learn nothing about the group membership of these peoples. Or another sort of saying it the other way around, if you also learn the group membership, you don't get more information about the risk predictions I make. One way to encode this idea of non-discrimination. There are others. For example, we could require that the error rates, right? I talked about the false positive and the false negative error rates. That's called separation usually. And at least for binary classifiers, that's sort of the idea that we have equality of these error rates, right? These predictions make the same number of false positive or false negative errors for the two groups. And then we have a third option, number four here, that roughly says, our classifiers should be calibrated by group. And that's exactly sort of the violation we see here, because these risk scores are not calibrated by groups, because we see these, right, on the x-axis we have our predictions, on the y-axis we have the actual outcomes, and we see that these two groups form. Were they calibrated, these two groups should overlap, and we shouldn't be able to tell the groups apart from this plot. That's sort of the idea of calibration. So lots of sort of technical ways to encode ideas of non-discrimination, and I think they all somehow make sense. It seems to make sense that we shouldn't be able to learn group membership from our predictions. It seems to make sense that error rates should be equal. And it also, I think, makes sense that sort of this calibration thing, that these two groups, that on any given risk score, the groups shouldn't differ in the actual outcome, right? All these seem to be intuitive. The problem is, pretty quickly people realized there are trade-offs between these various ideas of encoding fairness. And here we have two of these papers from 2016. And the upshot from these papers is then that if we have binary classifiers, when the base rates are unequal, that is, the actual outcomes in these two groups are different. Some people are just more often sick than others, for example, or have more comorbidities than others. And we don't have perfect classifiers, that is, classifiers that don't make any errors, which is like we don't get this if we predict social outcomes. Then these various fairness metrics are incompatible. We just cannot meet all of them at the same time. And these often called impossibility results on fairness have been super influential in this field of algorithmic fairness, and they mirror all the results from psychometric testing. So in some sense, it says, well, yes, we get this rich zoo of fairness metrics, and they all seem to be intuitive and seem to encode things we would like from our predictors, but we maybe have to choose. And it even gets worse, because these fairness metrics are also in tension with the ideas of accuracy, right? If we encode some of these fairness metrics, we might lower the accuracy of our predictions. We might make more errors, which is also maybe not a positive thing. But why is this risk tool, which I showed you from the US context, not even calibrated by groups? Because calibration by group is usually something we should get sort of for free if we just do unconstrained learning. So what went wrong in this context here? Well, what actually went wrong is the choice of the target variable, the thing they predicted, because they didn't predict healthcare needs, they predicted healthcare cost as a proxy of illness. And that is not an arbitrary choice. That makes some sense, because indeed higher costs correlate highly with the severeness of illnesses, right? If someone is more sick, they usually have higher healthcare expenditures. So it kind of makes sense, and it's data that is way better available. But it introduces additional problems, because healthcare expenditures are also correlated with racial background in the US, or ethnicity maybe in Germany. Even though in this specific sample, all of the people had insurance. So it's not driven by sort of differences in insurance rates. All the people in these plots I've showed you were insured, had health insurance. But anyways, the access to the healthcare system is different enough that sort of these racial differences show up. And you see this here on the right side in the plot, that on any level of sort of how ill people were, black patients had lower mean total medical expenditures, lower healthcare costs than the white population. And that directly translates into the miscalibration we've seen in the beginning, and that directly translates in different enrollment rates into these programs, right? So the choice of the target variable, this sort of seemingly empirical choice that is sort of just a question of how to do our data science job correctly, has drastic downstream consequences that are ethical and sort of that we need to consider from this fairness perspective. Okay, that was a quick run through sort of this field of algorithmic fairness, and that's sort of how these people conceptualize the idea of non-discrimination and build algorithms that sort of are guaranteed that they meet at least some of these fairness metrics. And I already indicated, well, there is this problem that we need to choose, that we cannot meet all these constraints at the same time. But I think there's a second problem, and that's sort of where I want to spend the last minutes on, and these chapters will be much, much shorter. Because algorithmic fairnesses focus on the distribution of predictions at the time of training rather than the distribution of social goods induced by deploying an algorithm in a concrete policy context, right? So in this little table, the received view, that's sort of the algorithmic fairness view. It's a highly procedural notion of fairness that is static in nature. And with this idea of prospective fairness, we actually want to provide sort of an additional perspective where we focus on the distributive effects of using these algorithms, and that automatically implies a dynamical perspective. So think again about our public employment service context, right? So A is our group membership and X are again our features we collect, and then together we use them to produce a risk score R. But this risk score R now is actually used to inform decisions D that are themselves causally relevant for the outcome, the chance of re-employment we are interested in, right? So the decisions are supposed to change the world. We are not living in a static setup, and we need to sort of somehow bring this into this idea of algorithmic fairness. And the second problem is, well, the same risk scores can actually inform or support very different policies. The Austrian idea of sort of restricting access to those in the middle group I already discussed. In Flanders and Belgium, they use similar risk scores, but in a totally different way. They use them to prioritize individuals at the highest risk of long-term unemployment. So they are sort of genuine political choices of what policy should we follow, built into or sort of built around these prediction problems. Right? Advocates of the Austrian policy argue in terms of efficiency, and at face value at least they hold an utilitarian allocation principle, whereas critics of the Austrian plan worry about exacerbating long-standing structural inequalities in the labor market. And they prefer to focus assistance on the worst of, right? Their policy doves, if you like. We might say they hold a prioritarian allocation principle, right? Focus on those with the highest needs in the worst of cases. So, what is my problem with sort of this field of algorithmic fairness here? I think this question, will deploying a specific algorithmic policy in a specific social context reproduce or exacerbate existing structural inequalities, is sort of a key question we should ask in this field of algorithmic fairness. And the problem is that most of the methodological solutions developed in this field are ill-suited to answer these questions, right? Just tinkering around with the error rates of our predictions just isn't informative about these causal downstream effects on the allocation, on the actual sort of who gets actually what resources. And that's maybe a slightly technical point, but many of these fairness metrics additionally fall victim to exactly this dynamic feature, it's called performativity, right? The intended effect of our policy to change the decision making, again in sort of technical or probabilistic terms, sort of the probability that of our decisions, whether you get a certain job or not, or job training or not, should change after we implement the policy, right? That's the very idea why we use, why we predict something. Like we want to be better in making these decisions, so we change them. So prospective fairness then as a sort of add-on requires decision makers, bureaucracies to anticipate the changes in society due to the algorithmic intervention. And our proposal is that we should use counterfactual predictions to simulate the induced distributions of social goods due to the policy and modeling choices. So what does that mean? Well, instead of predicting a general risk of long-term unemployment, predict the risk of long-term unemployment under different policy options, right? Instead of just having one Y, give us a vector of different Ys that are indexed by the various modeling choices and the very policy choices we have. How would the world likely look like were you to do X? And how would the world likely look like were you to do something else? Instead of just predicting one outcome where we say, well, it's either the case that someone becomes long-term unemployed or not, right? These outcomes are partially due to the choices we make, and we need to reflect that in these systems. And using Swiss administrative data, we actually estimated such individual potential outcomes for 7 active labor market programs and simulated sort of these Austrian and Belgian policies. And I don't go into the details here. If you're interested, you can look it up. But here are sort of our 3 key insights we got from this empirical simulation exercise. And the first is already said this, right? The fair distribution of social goods should matter a lot. To evaluate fairness interventions estimates its causally downstream effects on the distribution of social goods, not only on the distribution of predictions, and compare the level of relevant inequalities before and after our interventions, right? That should be the measure against which we evaluate whether something is effective or not. Do we actually reduce the relevant inequalities or not? And not just whether we're sort of fair in our sort of little decision-making process, no matter what the outcomes are. And secondly, we show that, at least in some cases, these algorithmic fairness interventions, playing around with these error rates, can be self-sabotaging. They can undermine policy that is aimed at lowering the overall long-term unemployment and narrowing the gender gap. So it's not always the case that being fair in these sort of technical senses of playing around with these parities is actually helpful to the very policy goal we have. And lastly, we show that, at least in our case, to deny resources to the highest risk groups is not more efficient than prioritizing those at the highest risk. So at least in these cases, there's sort of Dove supremacy. The Belgian policy is not less efficient in sort of bringing down long-term unemployment rates than the Austrian policy that is sort of seemingly championed under the term of efficiency. Again, something that might not hold always, but we need to check that, right? We need to evaluate these effects. Okay. Last bit, chapter 3. Reducing school dropout rates and sort of, again, this idea, this problem of ineffective policies. So say we are in a school now, third context, lots of jumps. We're in healthcare systems, we're in sort of public employment services, now we're in schools. And educators must decide which student to focus on their resources and attention to reduce school dropout. Right? And I think most people can agree that if pupils don't drop out of school and actually graduate from school, that's kind of a positive thing usually. So can we help these educators by predicting graduation probabilities to inform these decisions? Similar setup as before, we record a bunch of data on our students, we predict something, we show it to our teachers, and hopefully that helps them to make better decisions what pupils to focus on. Now, again, in the US, in Wisconsin, they have such a dropout early warning system launched in 2012. And a paper by Padomo et al., which I cite here, showed that, well, these predictions are actually highly accurate. So they do provide school administrators with accurate student-specific risk scores and labels. They actually are able to meaningfully sort of sort students in a ranked list of, well, you are the highest risk students of dropping out and you are the lowest risk students of dropping out. So they do well in these accuracy problems. But what their analysis showed is that the sort of actual treatment effect, the sort of actual reduction in school dropout rates was small and statistically insignificant, despite having a high, like a large sample on reducing school dropout. So again, I want to stress this point that the effectiveness of algorithmic policies is just not a given. And in this specific case, the authors argue that individual interventions are not necessarily even the relevant policy level. Right? Targeting at the school level, they show, is just as accurate, or almost as accurate, as targeting individual students within schools. Because in this specific context, students at risk of dropout are concentrated in a few schools in poor urban neighborhoods. Right? So in fact, there are just 5 schools out of more than 500 that have lower than about 70% graduation rate in a state with more than 90% graduation rates on average. So just focusing on those 5 schools and sort of building these algorithmic warning systems, collecting all this data, right? This is also expensive. They retrain these models every year, and that makes sense. They should retrain these models. But all these things are expensive. Thank you. And we could use all this money for other policies. For example, just to push these five schools and sort of provide these five schools with more resources instead of, like the shift here basically is instead of trying to fix the problem, well, all these schools have certain resources, and the problem is how should they use these resources and what students should they internally use these resources. The switch is, well, we could also ask our questions on the state level and ask, well, what resources should we make available to all these schools? So in other words, it is important to sort of consider the relative value of predictions versus other alternative policy options that might be just as efficient or even maybe even more efficient. And this sort of whole field of algorithmic fairness and using machine learning to make decisions might sort of artificially narrow the ideas of what legitimate or relevant policy options are in the first place. And with that, I'm already at my summary. And I think sort of the key message I want to bring about is that any claims of accuracy, effectiveness, or fairness of algorithmic systems must be carefully established. We shouldn't just take them for granted. We shouldn't just believe them just because people tell us that, oh yeah, it's machine learning, it's so fancy, let's use it. It's not always the most useful intervention. There are other ways to do things. Predictions can indeed discriminate, and that's sort of problematic. They are not objective things just because they're sort of technical machines to render data by mathematics into some outputs. And this fairness paradigm is helpful. I don't want to argue against these ideas of using these procedural norms to check for discrimination. And, well, just as an example, sort of choosing the prediction target can be super consequential. But I want to also push this idea that the, sort of this justice paradigm, like how effective are these policies in actually bringing about change, highlights also these sort of, or complements these ideas by looking at these distributional effects of algorithmic policies. And sort of in the last bits, we saw an example where individual predictions and individual targeting is not necessarily an effective tool. So in short, it is a highly political question, to decide which problems we want to solve, and then what sort of tools we use. And I mean, this in this sort of abstractness, this is kind of obvious, but sort of it's really important that we sort of push through this ideas of this talk of using machine learning, of using statistical methods to allocate social goods. And with that, I'm at the end of my talk. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to get questions. I mean, you can ask in German and English. For other languages, I would need help. But yeah, thanks a lot.
Hi.
Hi.
You mentioned Dove supremacy. What's the mechanism there?
So in that specific case, so we do predict risk of long-term unemployment, right? But when we are interested in efficiency, we are actually interested in switching from providing resources to non-providing resources. How does that switch change the likelihood of your certain outcome? We call that treatment effects. And the problem is that predicting risk scores is not necessarily aligned with predicting treatment effects. The one is a sort of prediction correlation problem, the other is a causal problem. In some settings, though, and this Swiss context is sort of such a setting, the risk scores are nicely linked to treatment effects in the sense that we could show, but that's something we actually had to show, right? That's not a given, that those with the highest risk also happen to have the highest treatment effects. And that's driving, or that's sort of behind this outcome that, well, focusing on those we predict to have the highest risk happens to be also the most effective thing in that context. But there are other studies that show that sort of this nice link between predictions and treatment effects is not always given. And sometimes sort of the link between both could look completely different, or could even be weirdly curved, where they're just weird bunch in our risk distribution, where sort of here it's efficient, there it's efficient, and the middle is somehow not efficient. So that's basically why whenever you talk about, well, I want to treat those where, the where I get the most bang for my buck, is that how you say this? You need to specify your problem as a causal inference problem. That's sort of, yeah. Thanks.
So thank you for your talk. It was a bit fast for me, so I didn't understand everything. Just a understanding question, what enters into this feature matrices on this dropout indicators or in this dropout machine learning algorithms? It's not your work, I know, but I'm just curious.
So they have a bunch of environmental variables, like what schools are you going on, what's sort of the average income level in the school district you are. But there is also individual data, like, I don't know, maybe your racial background, where in the US I usually talk about race, in Europe we usually talk about ethnicity, but yeah, that's sort of maybe your gender, maybe past school performance, these kinds of things. I'm not 100% sure, I don't have the list with me right now, but things like this go into these predictors. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we have two microphones, so you can just go ahead and then.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you also from my side very much for your detailed talk. Reflecting the third case study with the dropouts, could we maybe generally say that in this specific case it might be some kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy? If you don't focus actually on the policy of working on reducing the dropouts by applying machine models, as you just explained?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we would hope that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Or, well, no, we would hope that it's a self-defeating prophecy. That's sort of, right? We predict, well, it depends on how we set up the problem. But, well, we predict, if we predict dropout risk, and we say you have a high risk of dropping out of school, then we would hope that this allows us to effectively intervene on this student and help them not to drop out of school. So we would hope that it's a self-defeating prophecy in that case. And if we can show that it's not, and that's one way how they basically show that there is not a high performative effect of this kind, not a high self-defeating prophecy going on, basically, and that's how they evidence the case that, well, this is not very effective to do, because that is exactly what we intend for, right? I don't know, did that answer the question?
Definitely, thank you.
What I wanted to ask is, how do you deal with situations where, like, exact same result between different group isn't, like, expected in the first place? Like, let's say you have a system about healthcare where one of the variables is like skin cancer rates, and skin mm-hmm. cancer rates are different for different ethnicities based on skin color. Like, how do you deal with a situation like that?
Yeah, very nice question. Thing, and that's sort of exactly why some of these fairness metrics are highly problematic, because then artificially equalizing the accuracy or the sort of risk rates for both groups would exactly be harmful, right? So it's one example. Well, it doesn't mean that these fairness metrics are not useful overall, but it shows that simply certifying, oh, you followed this specific fairness metrics, you're good to go. And by the way, something I didn't focus too much on, but sort of these fairness metrics and these sort of this paradigm of fair machine learning is super influential also when it comes to legislation. And sort of lawyers in the EU AI Act, among other things, they also talk about sort of encoding these fairness metrics in law to certify the use of certain machine learning systems, right? And I think that's a very good example to show, well, we really need to think about when and in what context any of these fairness metrics is a useful thing. So one sort of the critique I focus on is it's not enough, it's not sufficient to just focus on these fairness metrics, because they are also these sort of distributional outcomes we should care about and think about. But the sort of internal problem is obviously also like, what is a relevant parity we want to expect in any given situation? And it's not always the case that sort of equality of any of these parities is the right thing. For example, when we really expect that different outcomes are sort of not a sort of fairness or discrimination problem, but sort of an actual problem in the world we want to address.
Maybe about the idea of performativity, where you evaluate how strong the treatment effect is, how well your intervention works. It feels like that always has to account for the intervention itself, like with the job seekers programs or whatever. Is it a program that's designed to get people who are just like in a slump right now a job, or is it designed to give people who don't speak the language like up on the job market? Like, it feels hugely dependent on the intervention itself.
Absolutely relevant. And I mean, these individual treatment effects, right, they are simply the difference between sort of providing you with a certain treatment versus not providing you with a certain treatment. So in that sense, the framework at least accounts for these differences because, well, yeah, maybe you just face different problems, but sort of given where you are, is additionally providing you with these resources helpful to you or not? They obviously also encode a strong sort of individual focus on like what we conceive as interventions, because sort of this is also again on this very individual level of how we set up the idea of being effective in the first place, right? It doesn't necessarily encode things like, well, we just make life in this whole city district better. And maybe that's not easily expressible in terms of these individual treatment effects. There's a parallel debate in development economics where they focus a lot on randomized control trials, RCTs, again in these sort of individual cases, and then they show, well, if you give individual money to individual people, that helps these families a lot. But it's very hard to integrate sort of more institutional settings, like we strengthen the rule of law, we strengthen the institutions, we provided better streets for the whole city or something like this. It's very hard to express these kinds of interventions in these treatment effect setups. Not necessarily impossible, but sort of it tends to do this individualization step too, and sort of that is a similar worry with sort of that's sort of a problem I face with my proposal of, oh, we need to account for these causal effects. I think that's true, but we should also not just run into this sort of trap of individualizing our possible interventions.
Vielen Dank für den Vortrag nach dem, was ich verstanden habe. Eine Frage, sehe ich das völlig falsch, dass aufgrund von fehlenden Finanzen, fehlenden Geldes in Basisbereichen der Daseinsvorsorge wir jetzt als Bürgerinnen beruhigt werden sollen, dass ja alles mit so einem, unter anderem mit diesen technischen Möglichkeiten, da Gerechtigkeit hergestellt werden soll? Also, ich meine, es ist doch die Aufgabe von Schulen, müsste sein, leider werden wir ja auch nicht so ausgebildet, aber es müsste doch sein, dass alle Kinder mit einem richtigen Abschluss diese Schule verlassen. Der nationale Bildungsbericht sagt seit Jahren, dass es immer schlimmer wird, dass immer mehr Kinder, Jugendliche, entlassen werden, ohne die elementaren Bereiche schreiben, lesen zu beherrschen. Da wird nicht genug Geld hineingegeben. Und jetzt kommt so ein Modell, um zu sagen, ja, jetzt wissen wir schon, warum Justus nicht mehr in die Schule kommt. Wir packen ihn so. Also ich finde das eigentlich hanebüchen. Und ich sehe das, dass mir die Augen sozusagen, da kommt eine Nebelwolke, ja, die uns klar machen soll, es wird ja alles gut, wir tun ja was. Genau, sehe ich das völlig falsch?
Translated, I don't know. Well, so the basic question, I hope I got it correctly, is sort of that, well, we have a general problem of not enough funding in these sort of social systems, and now politicians just come and say, well, look, we have these fancy algorithms, now we can fix all these problems, instead of sort of addressing the root cause of, well, we don't have enough funding in these systems. And I think that's absolutely a problem, especially this idea of, your metaphor of the fog that sort of doesn't allow us to properly see what is going on. this almost ideological effect of, look, we sprinkled a little bit of AI on top of all these things, now everything will be fine. I think that's absolutely sort of a problem that we should address and we need to address, right? I'm not always, not in every case, against the idea of maybe we can, against using statistical methods to make specific interventions more effective. Maybe there are cases we cannot come up with where it's actually useful. I don't know. But as you exactly pointed out, we shouldn't sort of let them blind ourselves to just say, well, yeah, let's spend all this money on building these fancy machines instead of providing the proper funding for the functioning of social systems like schools, like healthcare. And that's sort of the political message, I think, that sort of being clear on what the effects and the potential effectiveness of these methods is and not.
So equally not sure whether I understood you correct, but isn't it, some kind of magical, mystical thinking that doing decision-making by machines will solve anything instead of decision-making ourselves? So the normal scientific way would be to put them in hypothesis, collect data, and see whether it supports or doesn't support your hypothesis. And now you come up with some statistics that you can't even in total understand when you go to the large models and say all we need to do is throw more computational power on it and then the correct decision will come out whether we understand it or not. It seems to be fundamentally non-scientific to me.
I mean, if we don't test the effectiveness, for sure.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I was sort of calling for. Like, if we want to do these things, we at least need to ask the people that decide to implement these methods to show us that this works and how it's supposed to work, right? And that's something that often doesn't happen. And often the effectiveness of these systems is just presumed. And then maybe we think a little bit, in the best cases, maybe we think a little bit about the fairness of these things. That also often doesn't happen, but in the best cases, at least the sort of fairness aspect is covered a little bit, but the effectiveness question is often not adequately addressed. I'm not sure whether the idea itself to use, well, statistics to predict things, that doesn't strike me as super unscientific, right? I mean, we can use statistics to predict things, and sort of machine learning in the end is set up in this way, quote-unquote, just statistics.
Sure, but it's for getting information. Statistics you use for getting information.
Yeah.
If you use it for prediction without testing, then it doesn't have to do anything with science.
Yeah, I guess. If we don't test it, yeah, then.
If I may add, statistics are used to classify over here, and you can do that in traditional ways, like linear classifiers. That's done always. And the thing is, if you manage to do so, you get for the average a good way to say do this or do that, and that's what we do every day in everyday life. And in science, we try to find measures how good it worked or something like that. And it's done here with nonlinear classifiers. It's not so much different than traditional statistics. It's called machine learning, but in principle, it's a way to classify, is this in the one bin or in another bin? And afterwards, they check for whether it worked or not, obviously. So that's why it's still scientific, so to say.
Thanks. And to some degree, it's also not super different from the bureaucratic systems we have already in place, right? There's also a quasi-algorithmic procedure where sort of certain people are classified into certain boxes according to either the ideas or gut feelings of caseworkers or static rules that sort of sort people into certain buckets, right? So there is a continuity between these different models. But in either case, we need to figure out, well, are they doing the job we want them to do? And then obviously on top, we can discuss the political questions. Well, what is it we want them to do? Right? That's, at least for me, the important point.
Well, thank you very much.
Great. Thanks a lot.